Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Undersized Fist Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 5th, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Yates v. the United States. This case concerns whether Mr. Yates was given fair notice that throwing undersized fish back into the Gulf of Mexico during the course of an investigation would violate the document shredding provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which makes it a crime for anyone who knowingly alters, destroys, mutilates, conceals, covers up, falsifies, or makes a false entry in any record, document, or tangible object with the intent to impede or obstruct an investigation. To discuss the case, we have Todd Bronstein, who is counsel at WilmerHale. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Bronstein.
Yates versus United States is a case that has come to symbolize a concern shared by a growing number of Americans about overcriminalization. One aspect of overcriminalization is the concern that Congress is drafting very broadly worded statutes that criminalize a lot of conduct that previously would have been punished civilly or not at all. Another aspect of overcriminalization, which is present in this case in spades, is that the government is taking these broad statutes and pursuing cases that really have no business being charged at all. So in this case, the government took an obstruction of justice statute that was passed as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley law and used it to prosecute a man who had thrown some fish into the Gulf of Mexico. Here's some factual background about the case. Yates was a commercial fisherman who captained a ship called the Miss Katy, which is a vessel that harvested fish in the Gulf of Mexico. In August of 2007, there was a routine inspection by a deputized federal officer who noticed several red grouper that appeared to be smaller than federal regulations. He measured the fish and he determined that Yates had illegally harvested 72 undersized red grouper. So the officer placed these undersized fish in a wooden crate and told Yates to leave them there and bring them back to the port for investigation by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Yates, once the officer had left, directed one of his fellow crew members to throw the fish overboard and replace them with other red grouper that were larger. When Yates and his crew went to the port, the anomaly was discovered, and the crew member eventually confessed under questioning by federal agents. And as a result, Yates was prosecuted for several obstruction of justice crimes. One of the laws he was charged with was the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which is known as Section 1519. And this crime penalizes any effort to destroy or tamper with, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, unquote, with intent to obstruct a pending or contemplated federal inquiry. So in this case, the tangible object was the red grouper. The jury convicted Yates. He has appealed to the Supreme Court. Yates' argument was that the phrase tangible object does not mean every single tangible object under the sun. He said that the phrase is really chameleon-like and draws its meaning and limitations from the context. So in this case, when Congress criminalized efforts to destroy, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, it intended to restrict tangible objects only to things that are used to preserve information, such as computers and servers and similar storage devices. Yates relied heavily on the statutory canon of construction known as justem generis, which says that where a general word follows a series of specific words, the general is construed to encompass only those objects that are part of the narrower list. Yates argued that his reading also makes sense given the context in which the law was passed. Everyone agrees that Sarbanes-Oxley was prompted by the Enron scandal, and that Section 1519 in particular was prompted by the mass destruction of documents by Enron's accountants at Arthur Andersen, as well as the difficulties prosecuting Arthur Andersen for that destruction of documents. And indeed, the legislative history of 1519 is replete with references to this statute as an anti-shredding provision. Yates also made a textual point about Congress's enumeration of the prohibited activities, that is, the things that you're forbidden from doing to the records, documents, and tangible objects. One of those things you're prevented from doing is to, quote, make a false entry in the record, document, or tangible object. As Yates pointed out, one can make a false entry in a storage device, but one cannot make a false entry in a fish. Last but not least, Yeats argued that reading the term tangible objects to include all physical objects would create a really incredibly sweeping statute. There are hundreds of thousands of regulations, and the broad reading that the government proposed would criminalize the destruction of anything in relation to or in contemplation of enforcement of any of them. And Yeats argued that Congress could not have meant to have passed such a sweeping statute in a provision of Sarbanes-Oxley of all laws, that it was more targeted at white-collar crime and the like. The government, for its part, argued that when Congress used the phrase any tangible object, used a deliberately broad phrase to create a general obstruction of justice statute. And the ordinary dictionary meaning of tangible object is all physical items. And so long as the meaning is plain and the context of the obstruction of justice chapter in the federal code is clear, that's the end of the analysis, according to the government. The government acknowledged that Section 1519 was passed in response to the Anderson shredding scandal, but sketched an alternate history in which the law was really the culmination of a four-decade-long effort to pass a general evidence destruction statute. And they went through, beginning with the Model Penal Code in 1962, a federal commission in the 70s, a number of failed bills in the 80s, and argued that really the Anderson shredding scandal was just the impetus that got this statute over the finish line. The government also pointed to other provisions in the federal code that use similar language that have been that's been interpreted broadly. For instance, one section in the obstruction of justice chapter, section 1512, uses the phrase record, document, or other object nearly half a dozen times. That phrase, record, document, or other object, has been universally construed to cover all physical objects, and the government argued that other object and tangible object are materially indistinguishable. And the government pointed out that Yeats's construction would create some anomalies. A murderer could be prosecuted for destroying a letter that the victim sent to him, but not for disposing of the murder weapon or the getaway car. And the government argued that the making false entry point shouldn't carry weight because the court has never held that every verb has to match up with every object. Congress drafts these statutes broadly and doesn't mean for everything to match up syntactically. So at the court today, my reaction was that the government appeared to have won on points in the sense of getting a better reaction from the justices to their legal arguments. At the same time, there were a number of justices expressed palpable discomfort with the breadth of the government's interpretation, and this contingent of justices will clearly be searching for a limiting construction of the statute if they can find one. I think Justice Alito summed it up best when he told the government that you've got arguments here, but you're asking the court to swallow something that's really pretty hard to swallow. So beginning with Yates' counsel, he got a lot of questions challenging his legal analysis. Justices Kagan and Ginsburg wondered how a tangible object in Section 1519 could be different from other object in Section 1512. Justice Alito criticized Yates' interpretation for making the phrase tangible object essentially surplus. And Justice Kennedy highlighted the anomaly pointed out by the government using the hypothetical of someone who took a picture of someone throwing the fish overboard. If you were to destroy the fish, that wouldn't be covered by the statute, but if you were to destroy the picture, it would, under Yates' interpretation. By far, the most vocal skeptic of Yates' position was Justice Kagan. At various points, she really took up his cause and took up the government's cause and articulated a lot of those arguments. She minimized the verb-object mismatch. She highlighted the similarities between Section 1519 and 1512. And she basically waved aside the overcriminalization point by saying, well, you know, Congress passes broad statutes that criminalize lots of trivial things. That's just what Congress does. By contrast, when the government got up to argue, rather than challenge to its legal analysis, all of the energy was behind the questions about policy and prosecutorial discretion. Justice Scalia, in particular, was deeply troubled about both the breadth of the statute and especially the 20-year maximum penalty that it provides. He wondered aloud what type of prosecutor brings this type of case, and he joked that it must be the same guy, Bond versus United States, which was the case last term where prosecutors used a chemical weapons statute to address a petty revenge scheme. At one point, Justice Ginsburg asked whether the Justice Department provides any guidance on how to navigate between overlapping statutes, including overlapping obstruction of justice statutes. The government's lawyer commented that once the decision is made to prosecute, the Justice Department's policy is that you should bring the most severe charge that can be sustained. And this position clearly troubled several justices. Justice Scalia, upon hearing that comment, said that in light of that policy, he was going to have to be very careful about how broadly he construed criminal statutes, how severe he made them. And several other justices referred back to this policy throughout the argument. Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Kennedy, Alito, and Breyer all made comments that indicated that they were troubled by this particular policy. Justice Kennedy, who's always a swing vote, even went so far as to say that in light of the policy, he didn't think he should use or refer to the concept of prosecutorial discretion at all. The government acknowledged these concerns about the breadth of the statute, but suggested that the justices' concerns about this statute have to do more with other aspects of the law that are unrelated to the construction of tangible object as encompassing grouper. In particular, they pointed to the fact that the statute covers any matter within the jurisdiction of the federal government and the fact that a proceeding need not be pending at the time, as those are being the reasons why the statute is particularly broad. And they said that those are issues that should be addressed another day. Aside from the overcriminalization point, the justices didn't really seem to latch on to the key arguments that Yates was making. None of them referred to it as the anti-shredding statute, despite the very prominent use of that phrase throughout Yates's brief. None of them highlighted the verb-object mismatch, the use of the term make false entry, even though that was the point that Yates's lawyers emphasized. And Chief Justice Roberts was alone in emphasizing Yates's strongest point, which was that tangible object is adjacent in the statute to the phrase records or documents. So in the end, it appears that the key factor, based solely on oral argument, the key factor will be the weight the justices give to the overbreadth point. One ordinarily thinks of the breadth of statutes as being Congress's domain, with the court stepping in when there are other issues of constitutional dimension at stake, like federalism, as in last term's case on the chemical weapons statute. And those issues of constitutional dimension really aren't in play here, or at least the justices didn't emphasize them a great deal. Instead, the disagreement appears to be at the level of policy, and for that reason, I think that the government will get more votes than I would have thought going in, and they even have a fighting chance of pulling out a victory here, which is not what I would have suspected.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.